statistics on the issue of addiction. Over 28 million Americans age 12 or older have a substance abuse disorder involving alcohol, illicit drugs, or even prescription medicines. And that's about 1 out of 10. 30% of all people with mental illness have abuse issues, and it is estimated that addiction costs our country $600 billion a year. It's no exaggeration to say that everybody knows somebody who has an addictive disorder. And here to discuss the issue of addiction is Michael Giammanco. Michael has a master's in counseling and the psychology of addiction. He is a licensed certified alcohol and drug counselor and is a patient placement counselor at the Hazel and Betty Ford Clinic here in Chicago. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you for having me, Karen.
So nice to see you.
Good to see you.
Okay, let's talk about addiction. Is it a thin line between if you are an addict or not? What are the, I guess, the qualifications to diagnose somebody as having an addiction issue?
Well, my role at Hazel and Betty Ford, I'm an intake counselor.
Okay.
So I'm the first person they see when they walk in the door, and it's my job to evaluate whether or not they're abusing a substance, dependent on a substance, and we determine that based on how is the using of their drinking, their smoking marijuana, whatever it might be, how's that affecting their everyday life? Is it affecting their relationship with their spouse, with their family, their work life? Are they going in late? Are they drinking two glasses of wine a couple days a week, or are they drinking a bottle of wine 7 days a week? In that case, they're probably going to come to Hazel and Betty Ford to ask for help. So I like to say that people who think they might have a problem possibly do, because those who don't think about that, it might not cross their mind. But if they're thinking, you know, I'm drinking quite a bit, or I'm smoking too much weed, the fact that it's crossed their mind probably is a good indication that they're overdoing it, and the other consequences as well.
Michael, if you, for our listeners out there who know somebody, someone close to them, a spouse or a child or a relative or a neighbor that they suspect has problems and maybe is in denial about it and not addressing it, and they can see that it's causing problems. And again, you don't want to be a Budinsky, but what should a person do if they suspect that a loved one might have an issue? What are the best things to do?
I think it starts with communication. It's a key word in the addiction field, and if we don't talk about it, nothing's going to happen. So I myself am in recovery. I got sober 14 years ago.
Congratulations.
In my 40s, and I should have done it in my 30s. I knew for a long time I had an issue, and my family would bring it up to me, but they also kind of brought it up gently at times because they hoped I would come to that realization where I would stop. Families should bring it up to a family member in a gentle way, but they're coming from a place of love, and the person who's abusing the substances hopefully will hear that. They may be defensive and not ready to hear that yet. I know until I was ready to stop drinking and using cocaine, I wasn't going to. And so it had to be something I was willing to take that step with. So communication, it's the key. Talk to your family member about it.
So you hear this a lot, where someone has to hit rock bottom before they go to rehab, and I hear that mantra all the time. Is that a fair statement when it comes to dealing with people with addiction? Does there have to be like a, or is there often, I should say, a precipitating factor like a divorce or a DUI or something that tells a person, I got a problem?
There certainly can be. You know, it can be that DUI. It can be the spouse saying, you know what, you need to move out until you stop drinking. It could be losing a job. There's different levels of rock bottom. We talk about in my field, how low does your bottom have to go? And hopefully it doesn't have to go way down there, but bottoms can go pretty deep. I've seen middle bottoms, and I've seen people then go to that next bottom. They might come in for a program, for a Hazel and program, and get sober for months and have a relapse and come back after another bottom has entered their lives. So usually there's something that's going to happen that's opened up their eyes to say, yeah, I do need to look at this.
And the people that lapse, is that fairly common? I mean, I suppose it depends on what kind of addiction and a number of other factors, but would you say it's a common thing that people have a relapse?
More common than we'd hope.
Yeah.
And yet someone can use a relapse as a tool to help them in their journey of recovery and moving forward. We'd like to say it's not required to relapse when you're in recovery, but a lot of people do. I mean, I had my share of two or three, and when I went back into recovery and into a program, I had a better foundation that was already there, and I had learned something. 50% of the people can relapse, you know. It's one of those things where if they're not diligent about their recovery and putting it first in front of everything else, they're going to lose the other things, and they could have a relapse. So they've got to want it, and they've got to realize, you know what, that one drink, probably not a good idea. Some people are going to try it, though. They might have 20 years sober. They go back out.
Mm. So if you look at the people that succeed in rehab eventually and with some relapses, because, you know, the goal is to ultimately get sober, what are the characteristics that help people through rehab and get sober, and what are the characteristics that bring people down and prevent them from getting better?
I think the key element of getting sober is involving yourself in some type of fellowship with others in recovery. That could be AA, it could be Hazel and Betty Ford, it could be group therapy like we offer. It could be just doing something healthy for your life. You know, our program, I like to sum it up in two words, and recovery in two words. It's about self-care, you know, where people are normally not taking care of themselves when they drink and smoke and use drugs the way they do. It's a matter of changing some things in your lifestyle and being diligent about those things. But a key element is the social aspect and having a group of sober social peers and reaching out to them and realizing I don't have to do this alone.
And I know that sounds trite, and I'm maybe begging the question, but why does that help? I mean, is it just that you're accountable to somebody, that you are on the same wavelength, that they understand what you're going through, and therefore they feel the compassion, and that helps them? I mean, or a combination of those things?
I think combination, but I like to describe addiction as it's a disease of isolation. You know, when I used at the end, I wasn't drinking at the bars. I was drinking alone in my basement or in my bathroom, hiding right. it from my family, and being... opening up those doors and not having that second, you know, almost having a double life, is not what addicts are used to doing. So learning to do that, communicating, not isolating, it's key. It makes you accountable.
And one final question before we take a break here. And by the way, if anyone has a comment or a question for Michael, I'm sure he would love to answer it. 312-981-7200. I'm very happy that you have shared your experience with us a little bit. Does it help you as a counselor? And you tell your patients, listen, I had this problem. This was my problem, and this is what I did for a number of years, and this is how I hit rock bottom, and this is what it took for me to get where. Does that give you credibility with them that matters?
It certainly doesn't hurt. Is it a prerequisite for someone in my profession? No. But having been there, having walked down those aisles, so to speak, there's a sense of I can trust this person, and I might open up a little bit more. And I'm looking at Michael saying, wow, you were using cocaine and drinking every day of the week for 30 years. If you can do it, and now you're 14 years sober, maybe I can do that. My role, I want to give people hope. I believe anyone can get sober if they want it. That's the key. They have to want it. And so, you know, my sharing my story, I have to always realize it's not about me. It has to be about the other client, to the clients.
We're talking to Michael Giamanco, who's a patient placement counselor at Hazel and Betty Ford Foundation here in Chicago, and you're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
I tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been back, but when I come back, no.
We're talking to Michael Giamanco, who is with Hazel and Betty Ford Foundation here in Chicago. Thanks so much for joining us. This is a topic that's so interesting to me as a lawyer. I was sharing with you a little bit before the show that drug addiction, alcohol addiction really cuts through my business because a lot of people who commit crimes have issues with drugs and alcohol. A lot of people whose marriages are breaking up, who get fired from jobs. There is a relation between getting in trouble with the law and having legal issues and addiction issues. And I'm sure you have to deal with that side of it as well, because people who have serious addictions, you know, will have that additional problem, right? So let me ask you this. Opioids have become an epidemic, and the statistics are just overwhelming. They say that 115 people die each day due to opioid abuse. Are you seeing that at the clinic? Are you seeing the people who are addicted?
We're seeing quite a bit of it, and it's phenomenal how the population that we're seeing are young people. Kids, I want to say, between the ages of 18 and 21, oftentimes females, they somehow try heroin, snorting it for the first time. And they use it a second time. And before you know it, they're injecting heroin. And a person who, you know, she was 18, maybe 19, and she used to smoke weed and maybe do something else and drink alcohol, not even interested in those things anymore. It's like, I don't drink, I do heroin. So I do a lot of assessments with young people who are addicted to heroin or prescription opioids. And it's devastating. And is it tougher than alcohol or weed or other things? You know, addiction is addiction, but something like heroin is going to kill you quicker, most likely.
Right, right.
I don't know any old heroin addicts.
Yeah.
You know, something happens to them, and they don't live into their 30s or 40s. So this epidemic, it's huge, and we're seeing a lot of it.
And I guess, you know, this is not quite your issue because you're focused more on patient well-being and getting them better, but I guess it astounds me that there's so much of this prescription medicine out there and available to people who don't have it prescribed to them. I suppose some of them have it prescribed to them, and then they get addicted. But there's some people who get it from others. And how does that work, and what do you see from a sociological standpoint that is exacerbating this issue?
You know, what I see with the prescribed medication is someone will hurt their knee or have surgery, and they'll start taking prescribed Norco or Vicodin, and they start to enjoy that. And before you know it, they're asking their doctor for another refill and another refill, but eventually those are going to stop. So what do? They resort to buying pills off the street. You know, you can buy a 30 milligram Vicodin pill or a Norco pill. It can cost you $30 a pill, and at that point, the addict might be taking 10, 20, 30 of those a day.
So
cost is unbelievable, and yet they're going to find a way to support that. I mean, and these can be very successful business people who are just spending an exorbitant amount of money, because if they stop using that many pills a day, they're going to go through some severe detox and withdrawal protocol. So they keep using, and their tolerance goes up and up and up. And so they can get it anywhere.
Do you think that, I mean, I know, again, this is not your topic, but do you think there's going to be a change in the laws and change in the protocols on how these things are dispensed? Because what I see, and when I see people who are addicted to these things, like you said, they got it legitimately for an injury. You know, and for the most part, I don't know about anybody else, but if I had something that I had surgery, I take one, maybe I take the one the next day, and then I'm done. I don't want to take that stuff. It doesn't make me feel good. That's not my brand of entertainment. So what do you do with that bottle? And I guess some people sell it, or it gets found in someone's medicine cabinet, and it goes to the wrong person. So should doctors have a different protocol on how to dispense this medicine?
In your view. I'd like to think that they will and are more cautious. I mean, I think there's, unfortunately, maybe some doctors out there that prescribe a little too freely, and some that are aware of this and are watching it more, because, as you said, you'll take one or two and you're done with it. That's not your party. You know, for me, it'd be like, where's more? You know, I don't have an off switch when it comes to alcohol and drugs, and that's just the way I was wired, I guess.
Mm-hmm. We have a texter from the 224. Is dependence, it's dependence, but addiction. People who genuinely need these on a daily basis are being denied these meds and then are unable to function. I don't know. Do you see that? I mean, you wouldn't see that. That wouldn't be.
No,
those wouldn't be the people you see.
You know, I worked with someone recently, and she was prescribed chronic pain, and I'm the last person to say, you know, you shouldn't be prescribed that medication. But if someone's taking more than was originally needed, and they're overdoing it. I would just ask them, talk to a professional about this. You know, I'm not the doctor that can do this, but make sure you're not overdoing it and causing an exorbitant amount of problems down the line. But, you know, people do need pain medication.
Oh, absolutely.
You need to be careful, though.
Of course. I'm going to have to go to a caller here who has a question that I was going to ask you. Margaret, thank you for calling. What is your question for Michael?
Well, my question is, based on his personal experience and also professional experience, our concern with many of us is that our state of Illinois is wanting to use marijuana or pass laws so it can be used recreationally. Now, most people, I think, can understand accepting the use for medical purposes, but recreational use, we have concerns, and especially as a gateway drug, which the gentleman has explained, for people. You know, in fact, I know people that have worked in the field, social workers, teachers, and so on, psychologists. So what would his advice be and his concerns telling our state legislators?
Good question, Margaret. Thank you. Michael, what do you say about that? Is it a gateway drug?
It can be. I know I started with marijuana and eventually gave that up, and then cocaine and alcohol became my thing. You know, we're seeing it legalized in a number of different states. I think inevitably we're going to see that happen. And, I mean, alcohol is legal. And yet Hazel and Betty Ford works with a lot of people who are addicted to alcohol. There may be people who can use marijuana recreationally in a moderate way, but when it becomes legalized, I'm sure we're going to see more people misusing it, just like we do with alcohol. But I believe it's inevitable that it may go that route. I don't know that it'll happen too quickly in Illinois because the state legislators are kind of, you know, holding back. But I don't know that there's one simple answer for that.
And you don't have an opinion as to whether or not by legalizing it, you're going to maybe encourage people who normally wouldn't try it to try it.
You might, and yet you also might change some things where people are like, well, now it's legal. I can try it at some point, but I'm not as, I don't feel as obligated to have to go out there and try it with a friend. So I think, you know, the addict, the addictive personality, as you said about yourself earlier, Cameron, you know, that's, you've got that off switch. You're not really looking to go in that direction. Those who have that addictive personality and a penchant for abusing are probably going to move that direction anyway.
Yeah, and there's no statistics on whether or not the addiction to one drug makes you more prone to addiction to another drug, or has that been proven?
You know, I think the whole gateway concept, certainly trying certain things can lead to others, but we're seeing a lot of people who are only addicted to marijuana these days.
And, you know, interesting.
Weed nowadays, compared to when I smoked 25 years ago, it's a different ball game altogether. Just the intensity, the strength, and we're seeing people strictly, they don't drink, they don't do cocaine, heroin, it's marijuana. And it's a tough one to get off of, and there is
interesting, because like when I was a kid, that was not an addictive, it didn't seem to be as addictive as it is now. One final area I'd like to cover for people out there who are listening with children, and we have talked about how that works. What would be some tips for your children to watch them, to talk to them? What do you say to your kids, and what do you do for your kids? I know you have children. What do you say to them about these issues?
Again, I'm going to go back to the word communication. My boys were 10 years old and 6 years old when I got sober, and now they are 24 and 20. And, you know, they like to do their thing. We talk about recovery in my family. We talk about addiction. They've been to AA meetings with me. Talk to your kids. Trying to possibly prevent what might happen in high school and putting your foot down too hard, it might have that opposite effect where they're like, I'm going to go try this just to get back at mom and dad.
Right.
Whereas if you communicate with them saying, you know, you may be trying this, and I get that, but come and talk with me about it. Let's put some ground rules in place here, because communication is key, and letting your kids know, I'm there for you. I understand this. Maybe I've been there. Communicate. Put recovery on the table. let's educate our kids and family members.
Thank you so much for joining us. Michael Giamanco, who's the placement counselor at Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation here in Chicago. If someone wants to get a hold of you or the Betty Ford Foundation, how would they do that?
They could try our 1-800 number, which is 1-800-257-7810. Our website is www.hazeldenbettyford.org. And I'm at our Chicago facility, 312-631-7935.